Welcome to the Construction Industry Podcast. Fresh ideas for today's construction professional. The Construction Industry Podcast is brought to you by Remontech, Remote Monitoring Technologies. Find us on the web at constructionindustrypodcast.com.
Hello everybody, my name is Cesar Abed and I am your construction camera specialist. This is the 24th episode of the Construction Industry Podcast, a show dedicated to helping you navigate the waters of the construction industry. Whether you're starting your career, have been in the trenches for years, or if you're a construction project owner or construction business owner, this show is for you. Today, I'll talk to Dr. Milan Radosavljevic from the University of Reading about his new book called Construction Management Strategies. And on the tech segment, I chat with Mr. Tim Arthur from the Talking Tech Show on what's going on with RIM and BlackBerry. Hello, everybody. Once again, I'm bringing you a new episode of our Construction Industry Podcast. And today, again, I have a show that's full of great content for you, so we'll get right into it. But before we get started, I just wanted to give you a heads up because there is a prize giveaway that's associated with today's episode. And I will discuss what the prize is and how to enter to win the prize during our feature segment, during our interview. So make sure to listen to the episode until the end so you know what the prize is and how to win it. So don't miss the opportunity. Now, on to today's show. Dr. Milan Radosavljevic is a lecturer at the University of Reading School of Construction Management and Engineering, following several years as a demonstration projects coordinator for Scotland and as a production director within an off-site construction company in Central Europe. His award-winning PhD research used chaos theory in the development of the novel process planning methodology. He's director of the prestigious Reading Master of Science in Project Management, and his interests are focused on the role of Building Information Modeling, or BIM, in production management within the total construction service strategy. Dr. Radosavljevic spoke to me from his office at the University of Reading in England. Enjoy the interview.
And now, our feature segment.
Good morning, Milan. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. How are you, Cesar?
I'm good. I guess it's not morning there for you, is it?
Well, it's 10 past one, so it's not morning, but I'm kind of adjusting to your time here. Here you go.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Now, today we're going to talk about your new book called Construction Management Strategies, A Theory of Construction Management. But before we get that, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and where you come from in the industry?
Yes. I mean, looking back, I'm originally from the continental Europe. I come from a small 2 million country, Slovenia, which used to be part of the former Yugoslavia, mm-hmm. where after graduating in civil engineering, I worked in the offsite construction company, precast concrete manufacturing, where basically what we were doing is we were building factories and schools and various different other industrial facilities off-site and then installing them on construction site and sites. And then that was the first time where I got the experience of something that in the book we call total construction services. And then I was kind of lucky enough to get a PhD opportunity in at the University of Dundee in Scotland, where I finished under the supervision of Malcolm Horner. I worked there for another 3 years, and after that I got another marvelous opportunity, a job here at the University of Reading in England, which is about half an hour from London. And here I am now. So, you know, experience in offsite construction, I would say, but then having an insight into the UK construction industry. I mean, I haven't mentioned that during that time when I was in Scotland, I was, one of the managers for the demonstration projects in Scotland, where we basically, what we were doing is we were selecting the best projects and then demonstrating them to the wider industry, writing case histories, reviewing projects, assessing them whether they're of good enough standard to be called demonstration projects and so on. So that's my background, very briefly.
No, thank you. Now, having come from that background, where does the idea for the book, Construction Management Strategies, come from?
Yeah, that's another interesting story, I would say, because I had for quite many years, I had, you know, looking at how construction is done around the world and actually seeing a lot of similarities, particularly in terms of the fragmentation. But then on the other hand, having experience and witnessing what the companies, some of the companies, particularly in the Central Europe, I would say, Germany, Austria, etc., and Far East in Japan are doing, I actually realized that there is a better way of approaching construction. And I had, you know, for some time, I had an idea of construction 2.0 along the lines of Web 2.0, you know, mm-hmm. kind of, you know, let's reset it and let's start it afresh. I mean, it's easier said than done, of course, but, you know, it's kind of was, you know, this academic idea of let's do something different. And then, by coincidence, I think it was our head of school at the time, Will Hughes, who's also a prolific author on construction law. He hooked me up with one of our past professors, fathers of construction management, I would say, John Bennett, because he had, you know, an idea of writing a book about project management or construction management. And as I said, you know, he hooked us up, you know, we met and I told him about my idea and he was, you know, immediately, you know, excited about it. And he said, yeah, let's write it together. I mean, he's got, you know, he's got decades of experience. He worked in the US. He was one of the few people who visited Japan and had an insight of more than 200 projects and God knows how many companies in Japan and seeing how they are working. He worked for the public client organization here in the UK. He was a, you know, academic, you know, a founding father of Construction Management and Economics Journal, which is, you know, considered the top two, if not the best journal in its field in the world. Etc. Etc. So basically, we sat together and started thinking pretty crazy things about how to turn the construction over and where to start. And we kind of thought, well, the best thing to do is to start with students, but then at the same time, trying to infiltrate the professional practice by giving them some tools that can help them improve what they're doing. That's mm-hmm. basically where the book comes from.
Very good. Just a little parenthesis here. I think there's a bit of a disconnect between what's taught in school and what actually takes place in the construction site, from my own experience. I took a course once in construction management, and we spent a long time going through the Project Management Institute framework, you know, the PMI. And and having been in the field for a while, I know that it's not widely used, you know.
Yeah.
And so I kind of challenged the professor a little bit. So, you know, do you use this? You know. And he said no. He said no in front of the class, you know. So I really like that your book addresses the students as well as the professionals. Try to bridge that gap and. You know, so the theory that you propose will be able to be read by the professionals that are out there in the field, not just the students.
Yes, I mean that's the idea. Let me explain how we came about with the subtitle, A Theory of Construction Management. I mean, the whole idea of talking and writing about construction management is that it needs to be based on sound foundations. Mm-hmm. And when we looked around what the sound foundations were, they pretty much mimicked the fragmentation. And, you know, there's a lot of people that are trying to address various different things in academic community, and they're trying to address various different problems in various different ways. But because of that fragmentation, you kind of have ideas scattered around the academic books, academic journals, that collectively could represent some kind of a theory, but we both agreed, John and I, we both agreed that this is more to do with theorizing rather than building a strong theory, because there was no, even, you know, not that just there wasn't a consensus among the authors, but there was not even an attempt to reach the consensus. It was just basically everyone is doing a little bit of something, you know, of construction that is so complex that you kind of, you know, you can't even reach a consensus on on the theory. And actually, we realized that, you know, looking back at as I said, you know, decades of experience on John's side and my experience, we realized that that's not entirely the case. We then looked through the literature and realized, well, you know, again, this is not entirely the case. There's a lot of elements of theory that just needed to be pulled together. And beforehand, there was nobody that, you know, that would pull together these things into a theory. Now, what the challenge was to pull things together in such a way that would, you know, found a solid theory, but then at the same time that would be easily understood by the professionals. And I think we managed to achieve that.
Good, good. So you'd say your target audience is mostly schools? Or what?
Yes, I would say our target audience is mostly the universities, but and you know, because it's a textbook, it's considered as a textbook. Mm-hmm. We're hoping that, you know, it will penetrate markets worldwide, particularly on the textbook fronts. That means, you know, that the university libraries will buy into it, and the people who are delivering construction management courses will buy into it. And so far from you know, from my colleagues around the world, the response has been positive. We are still waiting for the reviews of the books on various different fronts. So we'll, you know, it's a pretty novel approach to writing a book. It's not a textbook of, you know, it's not a kind of a textbook that people would see before, to be perfectly honest. So it's quite different in many aspects. And it would be, you know, we simply wouldn't have enough time to talk about every single aspect of what is different. You know, but even if I go up from the diagrams that we presented, you know, we really, through the diagrams, try to really mimic what is actually happening in the industry, rather than, you know, present it in the way that suits a particular presenter. Mm-hmm. If you know what I mean, it was much more difficult to even create these diagrams, but that's why they're so much more informative, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, how can a book like this help the construction industry?
Well, there are two ways. One is the long term kind of view of how it can help, and that is through the students. I mean, if they get exposed to the ideas and the theory as we presented in the book, then some of these things they will carry on into their professional practice, and actually they will be exposed to the problems that we are trying to cover here and provide solutions to. They will be then later on exposed in the practice. And over time, of course, you know, like all these things, like all the theories that are being first developed in the academic community, it takes time to penetrate the industry, whatever industry we're talking about. That's one way. The short term, a way is to penetrate it through companies and professionals who might use it as a kind of an assessment tool, and, you know, and techniques provided in the book, they might use them as an assessment of, you know, likelihood of success of their projects. That has nothing to do with how good project manager you are, but has everything to do with the environment in which you work. And I think that is, or it at least should be, a quite tempting tool to have in front of you. Because we're not trying to say, you know, oh, it's the construction industry is fragmented, and because of that, you know, things are not happening as they should, and you know, you should be using more of this and you should be using more of that. It's nothing to do with this. The book is actually saying, that's the reality. Here you have the tools to assess where you are. And then you, as a professional, you can make your own mind of whether you want to go down that route or not. And when I say you as a professional, that doesn't mean an individual. It means companies, in order to avoid problems that are well documented in construction history, where projects that were, you know, pretty well planned eventually didn't succeed because people were not working in the right environment or in a suitable environment that they're used to work in. Mm-hmm. So there are two routes. One is through the students, the other one is through professionals. And both have got, you know, for both routes, what we were trying to do is we were trying to address both routes so that, you know, we provide solid theory to students. But then on the other hand, we provide, you know, simple, quick techniques for professionals to evaluate their own projects through 7 inherent difficulty indicators that can actually tell you the likelihood of the success of the project.
Okay. Now, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but that's kind of interesting. Can you talk about those seven indicators off the top of your head, or is that too much for this
yeah, I mean,
interview?
I mean, just they basically refer back to the theory, to the basic diagram, in terms of the inherent difficulty of construction projects, and that mm-hmm. is basically what forms the construction management theory, where basically what you have is you have complexity that impacts on the inherent difficulty, and that complexity is influenced or basically is defined, I would say, defined by the quality of relationships between the teams, construction teams that execute the project, number of interacting teams, their performance variability from the past, and then of course on top of this complexity, you also have external interference, which we didn't include in the complexity because it's actually something that comes from outside of the system. Mm-hmm. All of that leads to inherent difficulty, and all the construction management is trying to do is trying to address this inherent difficulty in order to minimize the difficulty. And that can be assessed through the seven indicators. Mm-hmm. And I can name them what they are. I mean, the first one is the indicator of established relationships. The second one is the relationships fluctuation indicator, which actually shows, you know, how your relationships within the project between various different teams fluctuate. Because you can have a similar picture, for instance, having a well-established relationships between some of the teams at the beginning of the projects on one project, sorry, at the beginning of a project on one project, but then later on, you know, the established relationships dwindle away because the later teams that come to the project at the, let's say, commissioning stage are not so used to working together before. Mm-hmm. As opposed to a project where, for instance, these established relationships are uniformly distributed throughout the project. Mm-hmm. That's the second one. The third one is the relationship quality, where we basically look at the team's ability to straight away start work based on the knowledge and the shared experience they have from the past projects. Then you have relationship configuration, where basically we talk about a lot of things that relate to the configuration in terms of, you know, how many teams, how many different relationships between the teams, etc. Then you have performance variability, which looks into the past performance of individual teams. And of course, the last one is external interference, which, you know, which looks at the external events that may impact the project and what their influence on the success might be. And basically each of these indicators is associated with a kind of a sliding scale. And the idea is that, you know, that what you do is once you assess your project, you can actually see on a sliding scale from, you know, I'm looking directly at the book right now to tell you what is in the book, from the red zone to the green zone. So the closer you are to the green zone, or if you are in a green zone, the greater the likelihood that actually the project will be a success and that the inherent difficulty of the project will be much lower than on some of the projects where, for instance, you know, the indicators would be all on the red side. And that actually shows in a way that, you know, if for instance, imagine you're a wonderful project manager that has done many, many good projects before. And then suddenly you face yourself with a complex project where a lot of indicators are actually on the right-hand side. What might happen is that this project will go pear-shaped, not because of your ability to manage the project, but simply because of the underlying complexity that determines whether something will work eventually or not. And that depends on quality of relationships, it depends on the number of interacting teams, and it depends on their performance, and of course the external interference. And that's what we're trying to present in the book as a helpful kind of tool to practitioners. And of course all around is the kind of the theory underpinning that is very useful for the students. Mm-hmm. So I would see practitioners not necessarily reading the whole book, but looking specifically at these IDIs and trying to implement them in their own construction projects. Whilst the students, for instance, might be, I mean, not might be, but should be interested in the rest of the book, in some of the subject areas that they are still getting familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Now, does the book provide also maybe a method or suggestions on how to move from the red zone to the green zone for each one of these items?
Well, what we did, yes, I mean, I would say yes, it does. I mean, what we did was to say, okay, let's take a look at what is happening outside. Let's take a look at all these strategies that, major strategies that are kind of pervasive in the construction industry. We looked at traditional construction, we looked at construction management approaches, we looked at design and build, we looked at the partnering approaches, and then we looked at a total construction service strategy. We looked at these five strategies, and for each strategy, we provided an example with calculated case of where a particular project in the case is. Yeah? So that you can compare various different strategies and you can see how one fares against the other. And considering the context from which you come from, you can actually then see whether a particular strategy is fit for purpose in that context. Giving you an example, for instance, let's say in smaller countries where construction industry is dominated by SMEs, but you know doesn't contain any large contracting organizations, it is the case that when you look at these smaller countries, you will realize that sooner or later that actually the majority of the construction is actually done through the construction management, through the traditional construction route, and some of them through construction management. But they actually, you know, you won't see a lot of design and build, you won't see a lot of partnering, and you won't see a lot of total construction service provision, simply because their construction industry is not kind of structured around these approaches. It's you know, the companies are not big enough, the companies are not structured in the way that would allow that.
And but when you look at the culture is not there.
And the culture is not there. But when you look at some of the bigger countries with large contracting organizations, with large total construction companies, those total construction service companies, like for instance, when we looked at Japan, which is dominated by the big five, who are all of them total construction service companies that can provide all the services from materials all the way up to the operation and maintenance, then you realize, you know, these are the differences. And if you come from a small country, or if you come from one of these small contractors, you know, it would be ludicrous for a company like that to work in along the strategy that they're not experienced with, no matter how lucrative at the beginning it might look, because eventually it might go pear-shaped. And an example, for instance, you know, I would emphasize one example in particular here, although it's nothing to do with the size of the country, to be perfectly honest, or the size of the company, but just an inappropriate strategy, is Wembley Stadium, when it was quite clear that the design and build company, the multiplex, were not they were not used to the kind of environment that they experience here in the UK. And they were not used to the kind of strategy that is used by the UK companies. I'm not saying that this was the only reason for the terrible troubles that they witnessed, but it was one of the major ones. Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of examples like this around the world, where simply companies are trying to stretch themselves into the kind of strategies they're not used to. And then, you know, they fail, not because, you know, they would not have, you know, a right people for the job, but simply because they don't have the experience working, you know, in a particular strategy.
Very good. Now, does the book come with any supporting material?
Yes, and it's growing. I would say, you know, in the time and age of internet, all these things are never going to be static, and this is something we agreed with the Wiley. It comes with the website on the Wiley's it comes with the web page on the Wiley's website tons of materials. I would say, you know, every single chapter is accompanied with a presentation, with the slides that could help, for instance, lecturers around the world going straight away into you know, creating presentations for their lectures. Every single case is that we present in a book is also broken down in a bit more detail with a bit more kind of flesh and explanations on this website as well. In addition, there will be, at the moment, I'm still working on that, and I need John's input on various different issues here. But we're working on creating a kind of separate platform with the blog, with the forum, and with additional cases that we will collect from the industry, supporting the fire strategies and supporting the calculations, where practitioners will be able to come and basically ask questions or shared experience or both, or you know, just come and discuss things on the forum and potentially have our input and input from other practitioners.
I see. And this website is it up yet or not yet?
The Wiley's website is up.
Okay.
And I'm just looking for it.
Okay. And is it open to anybody or just to those who bought the book?
No, it's open to everyone.
Perfect.
It's an open website. It's http://wiley.com/go/construction-management-strategies.
Okay.
I'll repeat, http://wiley.com/go/construction-management-strategies.
Perfect. And I'll have a link on the show notes so people can just click there. Now, Milan, you are going to give away a copy of the Construction Management Strategies book to one of our listeners, correct?
That's correct.
That's fantastic. Correct. Thank you for that. So
for a chance to win a copy, please leave a comment under this episode post at www.remontech.com/episode24. Again, Remontech, and that's remontech.com/episode24. And we will select one commenter to be the winner, and we will announce it on episode 25, which airs next week. Again, you can go to remontech.com/episode24 and leave a comment.
Milan, thank you so much. This sounds like a fantastic new resource for the industry, and I wish you all the success on the launch of this book. And let's stay in touch, and maybe you can come back down the road and tell us how it's going.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to give you an insight into the book. Yeah, I hope it will be a wonderful resource for the students and practitioners. And yes, absolutely. We'll stay in touch, and we'll make sure that you know, in the future we collaborate further.
For sure. And if people want to learn more about you and about the book, besides the Wiley website, where should they go?
They should go on our university website, reading.ac.uk,
okay.
School of Construction Management and Engineering. I mean, we could provide a link to that as well, but that's basically where they will find more information about what I'm doing research-wise and industry-wise, on top of various different blogs and other accounts that I have. But I think that's the best way to present.
Perfect.
Who I am.
Okay, and you're on Twitter too, right?
I am on Twitter. I am on, all the major platforms, I'm there, yes.
Okay, what's your handle on Twitter so I can...
My handle on Twitter is GMIG.
GMIG. I'll have a link to that too, so people can connect with you that way. Okay, well, again, thank you so much, Milan, and we'll be in touch, and I'll announce the winner of the book next episode. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you. That's wonderful. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And I have here on the show today Mr. Tim Arthur from TalkingTechShow.com. Tim, how are you?
I'm doing great, Caesar. Thanks so much for having me on today.
No. Thank you for being on the show. Now, Tim is a fellow podcaster, and his show is called TalkingTechShow.com. And he hosted with two other guys, and they talk about technology and what's going on TV and with the movies. It's a really cool show. I'm a subscriber, and I recommend everybody go there, TalkingTechShow.com, and check it out. Tim, and you were kind enough to agree to participate on my podcast here and talk about technology, which is great.
Sure.
If for the listeners that have been listening to the show, they will remember that every once in a while I have a tech tip segment towards the end of the show, and I figured you know, you would be the perfect guest to come and talk about technology, because you're really in touch with what's going on out there, and I get to learn something too.
Great. Thanks for the kind words. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
No problem. So, Tim, for our first conversation, I thought of we could talk about the topic of RIM and BlackBerry. Mm-hmm. See, a lot of people in construction use BlackBerries. And if you go to, for the listeners, you know what I'm talking about. Go to construction sites, pretty much, I'd say 99% of all the superintendents and the tradespeople, they all have BlackBerries, usually because they are issued by their employers. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we've been hearing the news. It's even, you know, on CNN and MSNBC that RIM, which is the company that makes BlackBerries, they're not in very good shape. So I think people are starting to get worried about their devices and what's going to be, what's the future is going to be for the company, and whether they're going to get support or things like that. So what's going on with BlackBerry, Tim?
Well, there's a lot going on with BlackBerry, actually. In most of the attention in the mobile space at this point in time seems to be focused on either the Android or the Apple iOS platform in terms of who's getting the press, positive press. BlackBerry started getting a lot of negative press in 2011 because they had a couple of major outages that impacted millions of people worldwide. And people depend on these devices for their voice and, you know, email communication, as well as using other applications on the internet. And that was a major blow to them as a company, and they have been losing market share for quite some time. My opinion primarily is because they kind of initially put all their eggs in one basket. They were really strong on the email, in the email space, you know, in terms of doing email and doing it well, which they still do. The devices are rock solid email platforms. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I have experience on the administrative side in terms of what it takes to manage BlackBerry users on an enterprise level. It affords you a lot of flexibility as an administrator because you have control over the device in terms of locking it down if it's lost or stolen, securing things. If you have a BlackBerry device that has a camera and you don't want people utilizing that, you can you know, kind of turn off those things that you don't want people to use. So it's very flexible for administrators in terms of controlling the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. Having said that, it's also difficult because you need to maintain an enterprise server that's specifically for a BlackBerry user, okay, which involves licensing fees and costs, mm-hmm. as opposed to the Apple platform, which is no additional cost. If you've got an Exchange server, it simply uses ActiveSync. There's no licensing fee. A little bit easier, you know.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the back end that I've seen. And it's a cost that companies are somewhat unwilling to spend at this point.
Mm-hmm. You know? So you think the benefit of having more control is not worth the extra cost and the other problems that having a BlackBerry ecosystem in your company brings?
Well, I think there's a lot of benefit to it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not saying that there isn't a benefit. You know, there is cost though, and as we know, since 2008, you know, across the globe, pretty much economies have suffered with the market collapses, and things are rebuilding slowly. Mm-hmm. But you know, economic times have been hard for many companies, and they're looking to cut costs. And technology, unfortunately, is an area that people shouldn't be cutting costs in, but they have to. Mm-hmm. And when the iPhone first came out, there was absolutely no administrative control that you could have over that device. However, since then, Apple has released many incredible tools for administrators that they now can remotely wipe devices and do things like that. So the enterprise interactivity on the iOS level is now there, mm-hmm. and there's no cost involved.
Yeah.
So that's very appealing.
So I guess what's left for them is the physical keyboard as the only differentiator, I guess.
Right. And I'll say I was a very avid BlackBerry user, mm-hmm. Prior to having, prior to the BlackBerry, I had the Palm Trio 650, which I liked. It was kind of buggy, but you know, it was very effective in what it did. That also, you had to utilize a third party email delivery service. So, you know, there's a lot of different variables involved. First of all of email goes through BlackBerry servers in one way or another. And if they have an outage, it's very detrimental. Mm-hmm. As opposed to the Apple side, where, you know, they're interacting directly with your internal communication system in your organization. Mm-hmm. So as long as your organization is maintaining their connectivity, everything should be fine. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't know. It's tough.
Yeah. Now, so, you know, I'm here in London, Ontario, which is about an hour away from Waterloo, which is where RIM is headquartered.
Right.
And so we kind of get a lot of the news here. And recently, they picked a new CEO, and they just announced the new operating system, which is, I think it's called BlackBerry 10.
Correct.
But it seems like at every press release that seems to be a positive thing, their stock just keeps dropping. You know, so I don't know, what is it that the market wants to hear from RIM?
Well, that's a good question. You know, as you said, they just unveiled the BlackBerry 10 platform, which is set to debut on their handsets later on this year in 2012. Investors were not impressed at all. And their stock actually hit on just a few days ago. Their stock hit an 8-year low of $11.91 a share on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Yikes. So, you know, this is a very, and the buzz about the OS has been pretty positive in terms of the tech space, but the investors weren't impressed, and unfortunately they can deal quite a blow to the company. And they've had some mishaps in terms of marketing. Yeah. For example, the Playbook. Although the Playbook was a pretty solid device, people tended to really like it. It was marketed to businesses when it really was not a business machine.
Yeah.
You know, they called it the Playbook. And yeah, I can see if you want to use it from the terminology of it's a playbook like a football game, you know, strategizing, you can use it in that way. But that's not the way it came across in their marketing.
Yeah.
And that was a major economic failure on their part.
Yeah. And I have one, right? It's the tablet I have. And I got it because it was so, they dropped the price so much to see if they could get it out the door, you know. But it was really sad because, as you said, BlackBerry was known for their email service, and the Playbook came out without an email app.
Right. I remember that. Yeah.
And for a whole year, it didn't have one, you know? So for me to check email, I had to go and open a browser and go to Gmail, and, you know, and it was not a very good experience. And I think that was, as you said, it's a very good machine, hardware wise, very solid. I like it a lot. You know, actually, even the operating system, I think it's superior to anything out there, you know, the multitasking and all that. But it didn't have the apps, right? And it seems like if developers are not developing apps, platforms just don't flourish. What do you think?
I agree. You know, the app ecosystem needs to be there, and that's where the Android and iOS war is still currently playing out. You know, the iOS ecosystem in terms of the App Store is incredibly broad. It's chock full of thousands and thousands of applications, and you've got the Android marketplace, which is still young. That's it's getting there, but they're playing catch up at this point. So if I can make an analogy to Microsoft made its bread and butter on licensing the Office suite. And really they were selling operating systems at a higher price, and they're still very successful, but they had to change their business models quite a bit. And RIM is not, although they have devices, RIM is not really a hardware company. Nor a software company. Although they do those things, they make their bread and butter on the licensing of the device services. And now, you know, the tides have really shifted in mobile. People want applications and functionality, and we're very much in a space now where people don't want to pay for that additional functionality. That's why so many free apps are the things that are downloaded the most in the app stores. You know, the free apps. You know, look, I'll take an ad if you give it to me for free.
Right.
And you know, the model needs to shift. RIM needs to adapt and understand that people don't want to pay for that, for the ability to use email on a phone at this point.
Right.
I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the other thing that, the other rumor that goes around every once in a while is that they might get bought because the stock, the price of the stock is so low. And if you add it all up, the market value, it's actually less than what the company's worth in terms of infrastructure and reach. Apparently they're doing really well in Asia and, you know, these markets. What have you heard anything about potential buyers? Or I think Samsung was looking into it, but decided not to do it. But
I have heard that name mentioned around, and it would mix. I mean, I'd hate to see RIM get bought by somebody else, unless it meant success for them in terms of another market. If they were to be bought, I would say that primarily it would be because of intellectual property at this point in time for patents. Mm-hmm. They would be bought for patents. And that's a shame. You know, they were the innovator in the space when smartphones first came out. And my take, as it continues to be, is that they have not innovated. You know, BlackBerry Messenger is nothing different than anybody else is doing, you know, and they had commercials and marketing campaigns that they spent probably millions of dollars on TV for about the BlackBerry Messenger. It's a great tool, but it's nothing different than any other phone has. Yeah. So they need to find a way to differentiate themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's a real challenge in this space because you've got Apple and Google battling head to head, trying to outdo each other every product cycle with a new whiz bang feature or functionality that they built.
Just to wrap up, I'll put you on the spot here. In the next 12 months, what do you think is going to happen to RIM?
I think they're going to be around for longer than most people would tend to believe. Okay. I don't think they're going to be going under anytime soon. They still have an incredibly large user base. Mm-hmm. And people, there are still diehard BlackBerry fans. And you know, it's tough to say. I think overall they're just going to be around longer than people think they will. You know, I think the tech news and pundits that are out there are always trying to sound the death knell for them. Oh, RIM's done. You know, well, no, they're not. Yeah. I could be wrong, but they were one of the major innovators in the space, and they're still here. And I like to be optimistic and think that they can pull something great out of the hat.
That's good. Yeah. And me as a Canadian, I root for them. I used to have one, sure, and now I have an iPhone. But I hope that they bounce back because, you know, competition is good for everybody. And I love to see them go back to at least, you know, gaining some market instead of just, you know, losing market share quarter after quarter. Okay, well, sure. Well, Tim, thank you so much for your time. And again, just can you, just for the listeners, can you talk a little bit about your podcast and what's about and how people can subscribe to it?
Sure. Well, I am the producer and co-host of the Talking Tech Show, and we can be found at talkingtechshow.com. It's a weekly show that we broadcast live with chat every Sunday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern time. At talkingtechshow.com/live. And we cover topics that basically cover the hottest in tech news, entertainment, and also we try to touch upon startup topics, entrepreneurship, whatever we can. We're basically just three guys that get together. We have some occasional guest hosts. We like to talk about tech and fun stuff. So head on over. And if you'd like to subscribe, you can just head on over to talkingtechshow.com/iTunes. That'll take you right to our iTunes listing.
Awesome. Tim, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, bye-bye.
So that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, you can leave us a rating or a review on iTunes so other people may also find the show. You can also view the show notes for this episode by visiting constructionindustrypodcast.com. I'm Cesar Bade, your construction camera specialist and a project manager for Remontech, where we have been installing cameras for monitoring construction projects since 2002. Please visit us on the web at myconstructioncamera.com. Have a great week.